KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Hamilton Bean of University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. This is a relatively new topic for Hearsay Culture. It's new from the intelligence community perspective. It's not as new from an open source perspective, but certainly the discussion of open source information, and we're going to define what that means, but broadly speaking, we're thinking about information that is already publicly available. And the intelligence community is something which is both counterintuitive initially, and also quite remarkable to think about. In No More Secrets, Hamilton, who has a background dealing with these issues, from a private contractor perspective, dealing with various intelligence entities in the United States, writes about the experience and the reality of open source information sharing and collection and the use of open source information in U.S. intelligence activities. And the book takes a close look at this issue, not only from a theoretical perspective and what the theory of open source might look like from the perspective of intelligence gathering in the intelligence community, but also has a very practical view because he's conducted extensive interviews with a number of people involved in the community, most of whom remain anonymous in the book, but who offer very interesting insights on information sharing, information flows, and the relationships between a variety of entities that engage in the kind of activities that we would otherwise assume and think are secret. And so the title itself suggests what the challenge is today in 2012, that is the advent of a world where there is a possibility of no secrets existing. And in fact, Hamilton quotes a few senior intelligence officials who have made this point in one form or another, that a day will come where there will be no more secrets. In the book, Hamilton poses, well, okay, if there are no secrets, what do we do? And if there are still secrets, well, then how do we treat those secrets, and how should we, in fact, think about them in a way that allows for more effective and more challenging at times information collection and sharing, creating and talking about in a, I think, a fairly balanced way what is a real tension between the need for secrecy, which may exist in a variety of contexts dealing with national security issues, in tension with issues of transparency and accountability and public input, where the public may have a right, might have an interest, might have an ability even to offer constructive input, help, criticism, and guidance to the intelligence community. And so part of what we'll be talking about today, and part of what Hamilton in fact talks about, are the committees of individuals that were formed, made up of victims of the September 11th attacks, and how they were able to impact policymaking on the intelligence side. But we'll also be talking about issues ranging from fusion centers, the data aggregating entities that we've talked about previously on the show with Professors Frank Pasquale and Daniel Citron, and some anecdotal information based upon the experience of World War II, public-private partnerships, and intelligence as a business concept, and a few other topics in the time that we have. And so, again, because national security issues have become a major focus of international intellectual property lawmaking, a focus of my work, and indeed a major problem as this show is being recorded on April 23rd, where there still remains an unheard of level of secrecy in the negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. That secrecy based in part and in large measure on national security concerns relating to lawmaking. It's very interesting to have on an expert who focuses on, in fact, the flip side of what those issues might look like, that is, what we can do with open source information in intelligence gathering and intelligence in intelligence communities generally. So, by way of brief background, Professor Bean is an assistant professor of communication in the Department of Communication at the University of Colorado Denver. He's been published in Rhetoric and Public Affairs and Intelligence and National Security, and is joining us via Skype from his office at University of Colorado Denver. Hamilton, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you very much.
Let's start off with a background question. You talk a fair amount about your background in the book, and I think it's helpful for listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work. Talk a bit about your background and your interest in open source and intelligence. How did you become interested in the area, and what have you seen based upon your past experience?
Well, thank you. It's really interesting. I didn't know anything about open source until graduate school. And I was going to school in Washington, D.C., and nearing the end of my graduate education, and was going around to different career fairs. And at these fairs, I kept coming across a booth by a company called IntelliBridge. And IntelliBridge, its slogan was, not just what you need to know, but what it means. And I thought that was a very clever slogan. I was interested in meaning-making as a communications scholar. And I didn't actually get involved with IntelliBridge until I got an email from an executive who worked there, whom I worked with at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. And he said, hey, I saw your resume in a resume book that was sent to us and thought you should come on down and apply for a job. So I did, and what I found there was fascinating. I mean, here was a group of, you know, well-trained analysts from, you know, prestigious institutions. Many of them had government work experience. They spoke multiple languages, and they were all on their laptop or desktop computers surfing the web, trying to find information in dozens of languages that responded to the defined needs of their clients, government agencies and Fortune 500 companies. It was a chaotic scene. This was back in 2001, the twilight of the dot-com days. And I remember very vividly that the company was growing so fast that they had torn down a wall between the office and the adjoining apartment building so that they could put analysts in the apartment. And they were working on computers perched on top of you know, the kitchen counter, basically, trying to find this information in what was called the open source, right? So my involvement initially was to market IntelliBridge's services to clients in both, you know, government and industry, and that's how I came to be involved with it. So I served as director of global business development for IntelliBridge for about 4 years, and then the company was purchased by Eurasia Group out of New York City in 2005, and I took that as an opportunity to exit the business of intelligence and study this institution from a scholarly perspective at the University of Colorado at Boulder, where I earned my PhD.
And so the focus of the book being open source, before we even go any further, I want to make sure that we're clear. To what does the title refer when you say no more secrets? And I think that you discuss it in the book, and I think it's a good way to begin the substantive discussion.
Sure. Well, no more secrets, that's actually taken from a line by the CIA's Don Burke, who at one of the open source conferences, I think it was the one in 2007, there have been two that have been open to the public. It's worth noting that these open source conferences were the only conferences in the, according to the organizers, in the 60-year history of the U.S. intelligence community, these were the only conferences open to the general public. And at one of these sessions at the conference in 2007, Don Burke said, you know, in 15 years, there'll be no more secrets. And what he meant was that increasingly we are leaving digital traces everywhere. So and that these digital traces will become so ubiquitous that it'll be very easy to find out almost anything about you because of what you leave on the web and what the objects that you use, like your cell phone, what they can communicate about your interests and your whereabouts and the rest of it. So I saw no more secrets in one sense as an assertion, right? Don Burke says, well, in 15 years there'll be no more secrets. But I interpreted it also as a question. Well, what does it mean, or should we not have any more secrets? And what does that mean for the institution of intelligence? You know, these organizations are premised on the idea of secrecy, and if their mission and their aim is now to gather publicly available information, what does that do to the institutional dynamics, to the folks who work in this sector, to the relationships among citizens and national security institutions. It just raised a whole host of issues that I thought were interesting to explore.
Now, you mentioned an open source conference, which, of course, I think to many listeners may be anachronistic, to say the least, that the intelligence community would be having public conferences about open source information. But I think in order to even get to that question, we need to define some terms. And of course, the subtitle of the book is Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. So to be clear, how do you define open source, and contrasted, if you would, with public information, which is another phrase that you use but has a different meaning?
Well, I mean, you're really talking about the heart of the book. My argument is that how people define open source has really led to its institutionalization in certain ways and not in others. So you can look at who is permitted to define what open source is and what other alternative definitions are excluded or downplayed. So, for example, if you want to take the formal definition of open source information, you could look at something like Intelligence Community Directive 301, which was issued in 2006, I believe. And in that directive, the intelligence community defines open source information as publicly available information that anyone can lawfully attain by request, purchase, or observation. Right? So, there, basically, open source information is equated with publicly available information. They are the same. What's interesting is that ICD 301 goes on to define open source intelligence as being produced from publicly available information that is collected, exploited, and disseminated in a timely manner to an appropriate audience for the purpose of addressing a specific intelligence requirement. So here the producer of intelligence is presumably an analyst, you know, who's both aware of a specific intelligence requirement and able to communicate with an appropriate audience. So here you get really what's a symbolic transformation of information into intelligence. It has to pass through the mind of an analyst who can communicate it to supposedly the right people. So, I think that this issue is up for grabs. Is open source information simply information that's used in constructing open source intelligence? You know, the former director, deputy director of national intelligence for analysis, Tom Fingar, he was also the chairman of the National Intelligence Council. He had a great quote at one of these conferences. He said something like, "Now only the intelligence community could come up with a name like open source intelligence." He says, it's just information. But you call something information, nobody cares. You say it's open source information or open source intelligence, well, then somebody in the community will want to fund that. And he got a knowing laughter from people in the audience, because in some ways it's true. You know, if you define open source information as publicly available information, then, boy, just about anything could be considered a part of this definition, right? So I think, you know, you ask a question that on its surface is pretty simple. What's the difference? But when you start digging down and to understand, well, whose definition is used, what alternative definitions are excluded, I think it gets very complicated very quickly.
Do you have a definition that you prefer?
I'm happy to rely on the government's definition. I just think that it opens up a bunch of other questions that are worth exploring. Mm-hmm. So if you want to call open source information publicly available information that anyone can lawfully attain by request, purchase, or observation, that's fine. But what then, you know, are then you know, ordinary citizens who collect this kind of information all the time, are they performing open source information collection, or are they doing something else?
And so if we think about this this issue, and you know, it kind of reminds me, as you're talking about it, with the you know, similar debate over the phrase cloud computing or the cloud, where there's you know, famous remarks by Larry Ellison of Oracle from a few years ago from a conference where he goes on almost a comedy routine reaction to the phrase the cloud or cloud computing and says the cloud is just what we've been doing all along. It's just now we have a name for it for marketing purposes. And again, there is knowing laughter among a community of technologists and people in the technology sector there. So, you know, if part of the question is semantics and the impact of semantics on policymaking, then I think it's useful to take a step back and think about what exactly we mean in practice by open source. And there's a couple of examples, both fictional and from reality that you use. Again, particularly for listeners who aren't familiar, and we are chatting with Professor Hamilton Bean of University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence on KZSU-FM Stanford. You use a couple of examples that I want to talk about or ask you about, Hamilton. And one is a fictional example, but I think a very interesting one. And certainly for me, reading this book, it was helpful for me to think about. You make reference to what I think is a terrific movie. And a classic, 3 Days at a Condor, a film from the 70s starring Robert Redford and Max von Sydow, where Redford plays a CIA analyst who is working in what certainly the movies would portray as a CIA station. So it's a townhouse. It looks like basically someone's very ornate home. But he goes out to lunch in the beginning of the film and comes back and finds that everyone has been killed in his station. And as you quote in the book, there's an exchange where later on, as Redford's being chased around by a variety of adversaries, both within and outside the government, someone asks what this guy does, and that is Redford's character, who goes by the codename Condor, and the response is, well, he reads books. And I thought that was a terrific way to put some meat on the bones of what is otherwise, I think, a fairly obscure activity that is intelligence gathering. How accurate in terms of for the listeners' purposes, understanding what it is from a practical day-to-day perspective we're talking about, how accurate, therefore, is that conception of what open source analysis or open source information intelligence is about? I'm not talking about the plot of the story, but really that description of what it is that Redford's character does.
Well, I think things have changed quite a bit since, you know, the depiction that is offered in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on the context. So, for example, folks that claim to be doing open source work, you might find in like the public health sector, for example, there'll be databases being generated where folks are tracking outbreaks of disease based on reporting in local media, right? In other areas, let's say the situation with Iran and its nuclear facilities, you might have analysts searching through Iranian blogs, commentary, social networks, social media, looking for information about descriptions of facilities, anything that can be gleaned through those types of channels. You might be looking at, for example, if the government is interested in creating an order of battle, right, for a particular, let's say, an African country. You know, how many tanks, planes, troops does a particular country have available? You can glean some of that information from publicly available research reports produced by nonprofit organizations. You can glean that from media sources, from internet sources, archival research. So it really depends on the context. You know, in the movie, Robert Redford, he reads books and he's able to piece together a CIA plot to take over Middle Eastern oil fields. The big difference here, of course, is that the folks that do open source intelligence work are looking at external threats, external threats and opportunities, and trying to fill in missing pieces, in a way that's cost effective. Why steal secrets when we can look through open sources and perhaps find answers? And the big difference is they're not looking, and they're certainly not, entertaining the idea that they're somehow going to uncover a U.S. government conspiracy as depicted in the movie, right? So I think that, you know, the movie is interesting. It serves as a useful way to frame a particular chapter, but we can obviously take it a little too far by saying that that's the reality that's depicted.
And I think it's by way of contrast, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I wanted to ask you about it as well. Again, you know, for purposes of understanding what it is exactly we're talking about, before I ask you the question that's going to come in a couple of minutes, which is, so what? I mean, why this all seems very logical. What's the problem? Ultimately, why the need for the book, which I think we can get into. But you make reference briefly to something I think I'd like you to talk about in a little more detail, which is that SARS research, the research on bird flu. And you tell a very interesting story about how someone, and again, you know, recognizing all the movie license, but someone akin to something along the lines of what that Redford character looked like, of course updated to today, actually was able to lead the U.S. government into apparently
sure.
working with
yeah.
the Chinese government on an issue. So perhaps you could describe that in a little more detail.
Yeah, this was a very interesting story. So back, I think it was 2003, one of our analysts at the time, his name was Dan Silver. He was an expert on China, and he routinely would look through, you know, Chinese websites, media, blogs. And one day he was in a kind of, you know, Mandarin language chat room, and he saw, you know, a reference to an outbreak of atypical pneumonia. And given Dan's expertise and that he's been tracking these issues, you know, day in and day out, he thought that there was something unusual about the reference. He couldn't quite put his finger on it, but he thought it was unusual enough that he wrote up a summary about this particular outbreak, and he sent it to our client, which happened to be the U.S. Navy in the Pacific. And simultaneously, he sent a copy of the report to a medical official who, you know, the chain of passing this along, it gets a little complex, but basically got it to officials at the CDC. And Dan was later...
The Center for Disease Control.
Yes, Center mm-hmm. for Disease Control, excuse me. So Dan was later awarded, you know, given an award by an organization called ProMed Mail, which is like an email alerting service in the public health sector. And he was cited as one of the three figures who helped contribute to identifying this outbreak of atypical pneumonia, which later, of course, was what we call SARS. And so this is the example that's often used, is an example of what's, you know, what the potential of open source, right? So being able to cue in on seemingly irrelevant information, but if you have an analyst who can interpret it in a way that can draw, you know, things together, it can be a very powerful source of information and intelligence and can be used to you know, help organizations anticipate problems. So that's, you know, there's those kinds of stories, I'm sure, circulate as the currency in the open source arena. You know, I talked to one of the major figures in this area, a government official, and he told me, though, that they try to compile a list of these success stories, but very quickly the best of these get classified, right? So that even though information is gleaned from open sources, it might be responding to an intelligence requirement that is itself classified, right? And they don't want to communicate to outsiders how they actually did this, how they put the pieces together. So here's a tension, you know, you talk about tensions in the book. One of them is, you know, we have some of these stories that circulate, but the vast majority of the best ones are probably things that the general public isn't going to hear about. So how do we understand how effective open source information exploitation is? Well, we sort of have to listen to the folks that are doing this and to the extent that they can share some of these examples. One that recently gained some headlines was the director of the Open Source Center. He was recently on National Public Radio, and he was talking about social media and how the intelligence community really was, you know, criticized for not anticipating the Arab Spring. And he said that in the Open Source Center, actually, that his team had been writing up reports saying that this activity going on in social media was going to be a game changer. And but you know, those reports were in part overlooked because you know, the intelligence community had not yet begun to take social media seriously. I think things like this are changing, but it's interesting again how these open sources of information confront an institution historically characterized by secrecy, a logic that privileges secrecy. And how do these changes how are they accomplished, right?
We're chatting with Professor Hamilton Bean of University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and the Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence on KZSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that Hearsay Culture is on KZSU in its first incarnation, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our website and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to keep listening. Hamilton, yeah, I guess the layperson refers to books they've read or to movies, but again, while you talk about these issues and particularly the irony perhaps of being unable to confirm the actual use and success of open source information gathering because of its classified nature. Yeah, you know, I was thinking of a book like the movie. I didn't even do the book justice, although the movie was pretty good. But Charlie Wilson's War, more recently, where you have scene after scene of again what is based upon fact. Although the book I think is incredible in terms of really telling a story that could only be true, given how fantastic it is. But example after example of members of Congress who, although they get plenty of intelligence briefings, are also able to piece together quite a bit from the newspaper. And, of course, the movie culminates in exactly one of those secret award ceremonies that very well do occur in the intelligence community, where you have Representative Wilson receiving an award basically in a warehouse environment for the work he's done on behalf of the CIA. And it leads to this so what question. And it's not a so what from the although we'll talk about it as well, so from the standpoint of, why should we be interested or concerned about this issue, but so what from the standpoint of, as you describe it, this seems like nothing more than what you would expect intelligence communities to be doing. You would expect that they would be mining whatever information is available, public or private, regardless of whether we call it open source or not, for purposes of gathering information to protect the interests of the United States, or indeed any intelligence service protecting its own interests. And so the question ultimately is, what sounds like a pointed question, but it isn't meant to be, certainly, why the need for the book? Why is this so controversial?
Well, I don't know if it's controversial, but what I'm trying to do in the book, it's really a study of institutional change. So there have been calls for, you know, paying greater attention to open source information since basically the early days of the intelligence community. And it was only in 2007 where you had officials declaring at a public conference that open source was finally beginning to be institutionalized. And the question was, why did it take so long? And part of the answer is that the intelligence community historically has privileged secrets. And so if information can be found in the public domain and anybody can lawfully obtain it, you know, why should the intelligence community be doing that, right? Many analysts traditionally have seen their job as more involved with looking at secrets. So when these two conferences occurred in 2007 and 2008, I was curious, well, what function are these serving, right? My argument is that they were used in part as a public relations campaign to show that with new technologies and new developments and the reorganization of the intelligence community after the 2004 legislation that required reorganization, that stakeholders within the community were now paying much more attention to open source, and that they were trying to demonstrate that they were responding to these changes. Again, my question is, you know, what version of this institutionalization occurred? And my argument is that it occurred in a way that maintained and, in fact, perpetuated the longstanding commitment to secrecy that the institution has. So, for example, there were calls to establish an open source agency outside the bounds of the intelligence community that would serve a number of stakeholders, not just intelligence agencies, but members of Congress and other groups that could use publicly available information to help make better decisions and to guide policy. Well, even though that idea for an open source agency outside the intelligence community was floated, what happened was a similar agency was created inside the intelligence community. What they basically did was take the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, or FBIS, which was created basically in the aftermath of World War II to monitor foreign media. They basically rebranded that as the Open Source Center, gave it new authorities, expanded budget, new capabilities, and said, okay, this is going to be our open source agency. Now, you would think that some of those products, because they're open source, they're openly available, publicly available information based on that information, that they could be widely shared. But in fact, they're not shared publicly. There, some portion of those reports are shared through a subscription news service called World News Connection, but the vast majority of those reports and the analytical products are not shared with the public. So it's interesting to see, how does this institution grapple with this tension between secrecy and openness? On the one hand, they're having public conferences declaring that they're using this information and asserting the benefits of open source while simultaneously keeping it out of public view. I think it's an interesting paradox.
So let's talk about some of those paradoxes before we get to perhaps some thinking about what to be done or how we should think about these issues. I mentioned one tension, and there's several others that you talk about in the book, and I think they all shed light on the challenges. And perhaps there's an institutional reticence to fully engage open source or fully engage public information, which at least in the way I read the book leads to some controversy, but perhaps not. But let's talk about some of these tensions. I mean, secrecy and sharing is one that we've kind of talked about. What about this idea of insiders versus outsiders? How does that play itself out?
Well, I think it's it was raised at the open source conferences, right? So you have stakeholders from media organizations, nonprofit organizations, interested citizens invited to this conference to talk about open source issues. But are those groups invited to contribute open source products, or are they invited to share? It's unclear, right? So the experts are the folks in the Open Source Center who have access to the intelligence requirements and are responding to those. But again, this tension of, well, why have a public conference about open source information and intelligence when you're simply going to rely on the experts that you already have within the government to provide this? I think that they are doing outreach to different stakeholders to try to incorporate diverse views and perspectives into some of these products. But again, who's permitted to contribute? What sources, open sources, are deemed legitimate or not? All of these questions arise in the context of making use of this resource.
And so similarly, I think, and this is one of particular interest to me as well, the difference between the public and experts. So one of the big challenges, and it's something that I write about and something that you have written, you write about in this book, is the fundamental question of whether, in fact, in light of this existence of public information or open source information, whether, in fact, the public should have a role in national security policymaking versus the expert who presumably knows. So really it's a twofold question. Again, what is that tension between the public and experts from the perspective of open source information and the U.S. intelligence community? And then more broadly, what do you see as the role, if there is one, for the public in making these decisions?
Well, I think, it's helpful to look at a specific case. So, for example, in the book, I look at the 9/11 Commission. And here you have, you know, insiders and experts involved in the commission, and they're looking at sources of information, some publicly available, to try to piece together what happened. You simultaneously have members of 9/11 families groups who are seeking accountability and seeking answers, and they are themselves looking at publicly available information to try to piece things together. And one of the examples that they talk about is something called the 9/11 timeline that was created by Paul Thompson. And what he had done was pull information from various media sources together to try to cobble together a coherent narrative of what happened. Obviously, he found contradictory information, open questions, things that needed to be addressed. And the families seized on this as a resource, and they used it to ask questions of the commissioners and the staff. They were able to ask pointed questions in their meetings with officials. And so it raises the question, well, what is the role of concerned citizens? And in the case of the 9/11 families, their participation was to some extent authorized because they had lost loved ones during the attack. And they were invited, in some sense, to participate. They were asked to testify. There was a family, 9/11 families liaison appointed by the commission. And so I asked stakeholders involved with this, what was the influence of the families, especially their informational activities? And, I got conflicting answers. Some folks would say, well, the families really didn't have much to do with anything at all. And their questions were useful, but, definitely anticipated. But others said that the families did play a major role, and that some of their questions that they had generated as a result of their, publicly available or open source research, if you like, that they were very meaningful and helped steer the commission towards issues, or the staff at least, towards issues that needed to be addressed. I don't think that there is an easy answer to the question of, what the role of citizens should be in national security affairs. When you ask that question, you are, basically asking an ancient question. The ancient Greeks, in Athens, they had a version of democracy, a strong democracy, where experts advised and consulted the citizens who then voted on the issues of security. The assumptions about, who should be permitted to guide, the policies of the nation, who should be able to participate in debates about national security, these are historical questions. Historically, citizens have been excluded, or their participation has been really confined to protest rhetoric. They are not invited to participate in the internal deliberations, obviously. But I think in the case of the 9/11 Commission, you see a kind of, perhaps it's an anomalous case, where citizens did have potentially some influence, in that the questions that were generated as a result of their work went on to inform the findings of the commission. Those findings, in turn, were used as the basis for the 2004 Intelligence Reform Act. So, but I think it's, the extent of that participation is ambiguous. But it's worth, from a theoretical perspective, a second look.
We're chatting with Professor Hamilton Bean of University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets on KZCF and Stanford and Hearsay Culture. I mean, to some degree, I think, Hamilton, it's almost a chicken and egg scenario, because to the extent that the public has any chance of offering meaningful input to any intelligence entity or the government with regard to national security, they have to have, of course, some basic information in order to offer that input. So, of course, the September 11th attacks were obviously publicly done. Everyone could see not only the attack but its results. And while a lot of information about the planning and coordination and so forth be subject to secrecy, the very existence of the attacks and its impact is something that everyone could witness. One of the challenges, I think, here which is one that perhaps I'll save for a future interview, is, or something I guess we can talk about it a little bit now, is how much information is actually kept from the public regarding national security and whether that's a good idea. And I think we can tie that in, to a point that I want to make in what I now call, that we're getting very close to, the unfair portion of the show, which is the part of the show where I start to ask questions that we may not have time to answer fully. Nonetheless, it doesn't stop me from asking the questions. And let me ask this one. You mentioned in your background having worked for a private entity, profit-making entity, who's in this business, and over again in the book, you talk about the intelligence community as a business in the sense of operating as one or operating with business values. And perhaps you could explain a little bit more about this privatization, if you will, of the intelligence activities. Because I think it does raise very serious questions, not only of privacy and security, but again of what we mean by open source information. Now you have that first-hand experience, but perhaps more broadly you could talk about intelligence as a business.
Sure. I think the leading commentator on this issue, I think, is a fellow named Tim Shorrock. He wrote a book called Spies for Hire a couple of years ago, and he really was the first to talk about what he termed the intelligence industrial complex, right? And he talked about the influence of private sector contractors in this arena. And one of his more provocative claims is that if you take all the contracting, outsourcing for goods, services, personnel, it totals up to nearly 70% of the entire U.S. intelligence budget. And I think that the book raised some eyebrows. And the intelligence community responded and said, well, you know, that number really reflects everything from the contractor who, you know, is in charge of, you know, replacing the light bulbs in the buildings to the analysts and operators, you know, within the community, and that it was an unfair characterization. But even when you look at the portion that is directly related to outsourced or privatized intelligence gathering and analysis, I mean, it's still a very large portion. I mean, one in five. Members of the intelligence community works for a private sector contractor. And so what I talk about in this book is it's a broader trend across all facets of intelligence, but certainly is an important issue in the open source arena, which is how do these commercial imperatives influence, you know, policy and practice? What are, you know, how are the issues dealt with? And you know, it's a question of resources. How are they allocated? Who makes those decisions? And are they being made in the best interest of citizens when you have commercial imperatives driving this sector?
And what? Go ahead.
No, it's fine. So, I mean, you know, what I talk about are some of the, you know, the one of the stakeholders who I interviewed for the book, you know, put it in a pretty good way. He said that, you know, the bottom line for corporations is the bottom line, but the bottom line for the U.S. government is, you know, did the information that we gathered and analyzed help keep Americans safe or help, you know, advance our interests? And so they're kind of two different bottom lines. And, you know, on one hand, organizations, for-profit organizations are concerned with, you know, short-term issues, market share. They want to beat out their competitors. They're interested in issues of efficiency and effectiveness. And they want to contain costs. But we also have these countervailing values in this country of transparency and accountability. And, you know, we want to ensure adequate deliberation of national security. And I think these issues, how they kind of confront each other, it's opaque in this sector because of the secrecy that's involved. So we don't really have a good insight to how these commercial imperatives might be influencing policy. My direct experience with this industry, back in the early to mid 2000s, was that, you know, that the for-profit companies were having a very large impact on stakeholders' understandings of what open source was, what it could do, and obviously those understandings served particular interests. and whether the the policies and practices that have been put in place are best serving citizens or corporations, I think is a question up for grabs.
You know, one of the I think the book is really outstanding in the interviews that you did, and the candor, by the way, I should say, for listeners in particular, the candor of the answers. And you, of course, you account for the fact that people may have agendas in speaking to you, but that's almost secondary to the fact that I think you got very candid responses to very tough questions, including with regard to this issue. I thought was a very telling comment was one of the contractors whom you interviewed, who was asked this basic question about their interactions with the government, and this was in the context of the fact that the government, under some directives that you've referred to in the book and that you referred to here in the interview, are required to meet certain best practices, including using open source. And one of the contractors pointed out, with regard to how their product is actually used, they said, I'm paraphrasing it, but they basically analogize themselves to selling grapes, and they harvest grapes and they sell grapes, and that's it. And as long as the government's going to buy the grapes, it doesn't really matter what happens to it as far as they're concerned once it enters the government. So that to the extent that the government is using, or I should say procuring, open source information or open source capabilities from the private sector, they're paying, the government, that is the taxpayer, is paying for this service, and then it's up to the government to use it or not, but that's a secondary, or even not a secondary, according to that quote. It's really not a concern at all of private contractors, getting, I think, directly to that issue of values, which I think is a critical one, and one which, again, I've already done this once, but I will invite you back on the show to continue that discussion. With the remaining 5 minutes we have left, I want to ask you really two questions. And I think it's a good way to close this interview. I'll ask for, and it's somewhat of a crystal ball question, but I think it's based on your experience. So, with regard to the quote that is forms the title of your book, do you believe that 15 years from now there will be no more secrets?
No. I think I think Don Burke's claim about that was intentionally provocative. I think that we've seen, in the fairly recent expose by Washington Post reporters Dana Priest and Willie Markin in Top Secret America, I mean, the secret intelligence is going nowhere. I think that, again, my use of that quote was more to provoke a discussion. Should there be no more secrets, right? And if we are moving in a direction where there are fewer secrets, what does that mean for institutional change and reform in the intelligence community, and how do citizens and their government interact in these changing contexts? So, I certainly don't subscribe to the idea that, everything can be gleaned from open source information and intelligence, if that answers your question.
No, I think it does. I mean, and it gets to, and given that conclusion, I think the use of that quote and the issue of being provocative, I think, is one certainly that I'll ask you about in the last 30 seconds. It does seem like, even if the word controversial may be stating it differently, there is an enormous reticence inside the intelligence community to actually use public information for the reasons both sociological and political that we've talked about. So I guess I'll ask you one more crystal ball question. In light of where we stand today, do you think, again, 15 years from now, that we will still be having the same discussion about the challenges facing the intelligence community in inculcating a value system that would allows for the use of open source, however it's defined, in a way that isn't viewed as undermining the art?
Yeah, I think that the issues that confront open source stakeholders have been around since World War II. The issues of how do you collect information effectively, how do you use it, who do you disseminate this information to, how do you protect sources and methods of intelligence, how do you protect open source information from falling into the hands of enemies. I mean, these are issues that we have confronted for the last, 60-plus years, and will continue to confront even as we develop new technologies, social media, network technologies. I think that these are enduring questions that will continue to engage folks who are interested in this sector.
And let me ask you this very practical question, and it's one that I think is useful for in particular for listeners that want to attempt to learn more about the intelligence community or even follow, to the extent possible, the activities of the intelligence community. I think you've mentioned, in passing, certainly in the books and publications, but if you were to set up as a reading list, as it were, for people who want to follow this issue, what would you recommend they read?
I think a good starting place would be, again, Tim Shorrock's work on Spies for Hire. I think you can glean an immense amount of information from the intelligence community itself. It is now, very invested in its own public relations, so to speak. And you can, of course, glean insights from, the major newspapers that are tracking, developments in intelligence and national security affairs. There are also a number of think tanks, within the Washington D.C. area that specialize in these issues. So,
do you have any? Let me ask the question more specifically. Are there particular newspapers or think tanks that you think would be particularly good sources for people to look to?
There are a number of sources I point to in the book. I think it really depends on your particular interest, and what you're hoping to learn. I don't want to be seen as promoting any particular outlet over any other.
Okay. With regard to the last couple of minutes that we have, last question, a very nuts and bolts one. You mentioned to me prior to the interview that there is, in fact, a Facebook page, open source, in a matter of speaking, for the book. So for people that want to learn more about the book and your work, where can they go?
Well, there's a Facebook group. It's called No More Secrets. If they just type that into the search engine, it'll bring it right up. And I occasionally post information there on open source developments, and I invite people to continue the conversation there.
Hamilton Bean, professor at University of Colorado Denver, author of the book No More Secrets, Open Source Information and Reshaping of U.S. Intelligence. Fascinating book, again, for anyone interested. Again, even beyond the intelligence community, I think it's a really challenging book involving information sharing. It's certainly recommended. Thank you for joining us today on the show and bringing this, at least for our show, unusual topic to our attention.
Thank you for having me.
Let me mention a number of guests that are coming up for the remainder of the semester. Following in this kind of focus on secrecy, one more week. Next week we'll have Professor Daniel Margoxi on of Hunter College, co-editor of the forthcoming volume of the British Journal for the History of Science entitled States of Secrecy. Following that, Professor Leah Shaver of Hofstra Law regarding her article Illuminating Innovation. May 15th, Baron Zilke of Tech Freedom, co-editor of the book The Next Digital Decade. May 22nd, Christopher Segoy and Stephanie K. Pell, co-authors of the article Can You See Me Now? Towards Reasonable Standards for Law Enforcement Access to Location Data that Congress Could Enact. May 29th, Marvin Amori, author of the article First Amendment Architecture. Professor Brett Frischman on June 5th of Cardozo Law, author of Infrastructure, the Social Value of Shared Resources. And I'm excited also to mention that coming up to round out the semester will be Mike Masnick of TechDirt, who I think has done incredible reporting, almost unique reporting, on a variety of issues, including international IP lawmaking. And so I'm very excited to have Mike on the show and to talk not only about his work, but also about TechDirt, which is a site of which I am a huge fan of. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can tune in this quarter, Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU-FM Stanford, where you can get the show. And that's the first time that you'll be able to hear a given show. But if you want to wait, not necessarily encouraged, but there are conveniences associated with podcasts. You can pick up the show via podcast by going either to the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu and the web and CIS's webpage is actively posting the shows, as I do. And I should on air thank both Joe Nato of the AV crew at Stanford Law School, who does an incredible job and has from the beginning of the show in posting the show on Stanford's cyber law servers, and Elaine Adolfo, who posts the show directly as a blog post on CIS's webpage. I thank them for their continued work, and Joe in particular, who's been doing this from the get-go. And anyway, if you're not going to get the show that way, you can also get the show by going to CIS's iTunes page, and Joe and Elaine are also involved in putting it there, where you can get not only Hearsay Culture, but other events occurring at Stanford CIS. Or you can go to hearsayculture.com, my website, which has all previous 160-odd shows, as well as the upcoming schedule. I should also mention, and again, it's an honor of sorts, although it's one that I really wish I was not, I did not have the honor of. But I am again, and Hearsay Culture has been the subject of another Link Farm attack, which is being currently on a volunteer basis resolved. And so hopefully that issue will be resolved again, and Hearsay Culture will be in good standing. Again, I assure listeners that I am not in the side business of selling Viagra and Cialis, for those of you that are wondering, and I'm dealing with that issue, and I thank Oliver Day in particular for his work in addressing it. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.